Time for our weekly update. Malcolm Honlein with us, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, Friday, 7:40 a.m. Eastern Time here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you.
I appreciate that. And as I said to you off the air, thank God you're sounding much better and that the pneumonia is behind you. So I didn't think anything could put the recent presidential election out of the headline spot of the weekly update, but I'm going with my gut. And just like on November the 9th and 10th of 1938, we know those 2 days as Kristallnacht, now November the 7th of 2024, 86 years later, in Amsterdam, this unbelievable act of pogrom takes place. The difference, of course, in the 86 years is now we have a state of Israel. And if you think that doesn't make a difference, folks, pay careful attention to what's happening in the news. Malcolm, you have a lot of connections in the Amsterdam Jewish community, and you certainly have seen, I'm sure, the videos and read the reports from last night. What could you tell us regarding yesterday's pogrom?
Well, certainly one of the most upsetting events in this year of upsetting events. And remember that you have Geert Wilders in the government who's very pro-Israel, very right-wing. They were caught, obviously, completely unawares or unwilling on the part of the police to respond. They stood by the limited number that were there as the game ended and the Israeli fans came out. There was an organized, and I think President Herzog's characterization of a pogrom is not exaggerated. They waited in groups of 5 to 10. They attacked them. There are still three that are unaccounted for. There were Israelis thrown into the canals. There were people beaten unconscious and continued to be assaulted. The Israelis ran and hid in buildings and in restaurants and in all sorts of places until there was some effort on the part of the police. They arrested several dozen people out of this mob, but it was clearly an organized assault. It was vicious beyond reason. And then the media starts qualifying it and saying, well, they came out of the game. Then we heard an anti-Palestinian thing. They ripped down a flag. Nobody knows and heard of this thing about ripping down a flag. And if they did, it doesn't mean they did it. This all could be a provocation as an excuse for the retaliation. People, you know, his image of Holland is wrong. The vast majority of Dutch Jews were killed. Remember Anne Frank, and I discovered recently that my father and Anne Frank's father were related.
Wow.
And, you know, as you discover when you do research, we find all the connections. So it sort of personalizes it, although I think everybody has read the book, and the fact, the focus on one person, on Anne Frank, taught us a lot about 6 million is too much to understand. One person you can. So there's a history in Holland. You know, there are mythologies about Denmark, about other places during the Shoah that were given currency. This is an outrage. And if people don't suffer the consequences, you have to pray for those who are missing. Their phones were taken. Their passports were taken. Some already appeared online of officers, Israeli army officers who were there, whose pictures were put online. So it has a lot of ramifications.
Talk about the after effects of October 7th. Obviously, this mob and this coordinated effort, doesn't that phrase ring a bell, obviously was emulating what Hamas did on the 7th of October, and these are Hamas at the minimum. Maybe I could use the word Hamas operatives, certainly Hamas sympathizers who wanted to emulate what they did. In fact, Zvi Yechezkeli pointed out that if they would have had ammunition like Hamas did on October 7th, they would have used that and actually murdered Jews right there and then by that means. Now, first, again, that in mind, because we know that we're about to hit day 400, is it possible that a number of those three who are missing are actually being held hostage, that they've taken this emulation of Hamas to that level?
We hope not. There is no details yet. The families have said they have not heard from their loved ones. And as I said, the phones were taken, and sometimes the Muslims who attack them answer the phones when the families call them. So we have to wait until the dust settles and Israel, as you know, sent planes to Amsterdam to evacuate people and to get them out safely, and also sent medicines and for treatment. At least 10 were supposedly hospitalized, and some of them pretty seriously injured, as well as those were missing. But I think your point is a good one, that the images, knowing what Hamas did and what Hezbollah planned to do, which was a mega October 7th event, and the fact that you've had attacks against Jews in so many places, three against adult males in Berlin just in the last week or so, that it becomes open season. Yep. And the actions of government, it's not sufficient to have condemnations. It's not sufficient. We want to know why weren't they prepared for this? Why didn't they take the actions that they were supposed to, especially when Geert Wilders is supposedly so committed to Israel and the pro-Jewish agenda and very anti-Muslim, anti-whatever, which is not the criteria for acting. This is a matter of justice. It doesn't matter who did it. But in this case, we see that it's Turks and Iranians were amongst those arrested so far. It tells you what the situation in Europe is like and what potentially could happen in America and everywhere else. We have mass migrations when you have, you know, millions of people, and that the of Muslims particularly, but who have been indoctrinated and who are subject to the calls of the most extremist voices. Is not all Muslims, and certainly it has to be, you know, put in the right context, but the danger should be very clear to everyone, and Europe is paying the price for it.
And if you think, as you just pointed out, that the fascination with Hamas activities is, you know, that we're immune from it in New York. And I'm saying New York specifically because obviously the biggest Jewish presence, and a very effective police force, et cetera, et cetera. If you think there's an immunity from that here in this area, then you're blind to what's happening, because what happened in Amsterdam last night, I think you'd agree, Malcolm, you could have woken up this morning and heard about it in any major city on this globe. It happened to happen in Amsterdam yesterday.
And certainly in any city in Europe and in much of the world today, the public actions against Jews and, quote, Israelis, but it applies to all of them, where we have boycotts, BDS movements, other things going on. And, you know, for how many years, decades, I've talked about this on this, because it isn't just happened. And I know many people who come up to me literally every day and say and apologize, saying, you know, they thought it was very extreme what I was saying, that it was, too much, and now understand. And I told them, I only told you the tip of the iceberg, because if I told you everything, you certainly wouldn't have believed it. And this is not new, but you know, Nahum, that people, I'm sure, said it to you and they said it to me. You know, could all of this really be happening? And it doesn't just happen. November 9th, 1938 didn't just happen. We published a book about many years ago, a number of years ago, about all the shuls that were destroyed on Kristallnacht. The history book said 195, 225, et cetera. We documented more than 1,700 Shtiblichen shuls that were destroyed.
Wow.
It's such a concerted effort. It was such an organized effort. Plus tens of thousands of Jews were arrested and many sent to concentration camps already then. This is, you know, a mythology. We're just waiting for the excuse to do it.
And remember, in those days, there was no social media to gather people within minutes.
Exactly. But you had a Nazi party that was organizing, and you have, you know, unfortunately here, people who engage in that kind of rhetoric and are not held to account. And then you pay a price. So we have to be vigilant. We have to be vigilant about what goes on in the campuses, what goes on in the communities. And when you have people who make blatantly anti-Semitic comments, we don't let them go. We got to act against them, take legal action, take all kinds of, you know, steps with our government officials at the city, the state, and the federal level, because you can't let this cancer metastasize and then turn around later and say, how did it happen?
And the state of Israel, as you mentioned, sending a delegation there, including the foreign minister to Amsterdam, I'm referring to, flying planes on Shabbos. And I wouldn't even use the term Mechallel Shabbos. They're being Mevatel Shabbos, because they're setting Shabbos aside because it's a matter of life and death. And we should remember that. They're not in any way degrading Shabbos. It's just the opposite. They are doing what they can to save Jewish lives in the situation there. And in addition to that, I'm assuming that there'll be more political fallout, hopefully from other countries and maybe even the UN, who knows, responding to all of this. My point, Malcolm, of course, is as we're in the 77th year of the existence of the State of Israel, what kind of pachad, what kind of fright did so many generations and centuries of our ancestors go through when there was nobody, certainly no organized government, to stand up on their behalf when something like this would happen?
It's an important message and reminder to the people. By the way, no chance the UN will do anything. They don't. Look, you know, I just wanted to give an example to the audience to remember. We had this week the execution of four people claimed that they were spying for Israel in Iran. The execution of Arvin, a 23-year-old innocent person that the courts were ready to reverse. We invested heavily in getting lawyers and things to and efforts around the world on his behalf. And clearly, everybody said it was an act of self-defense. He didn't do anything. He was attacked while he was working out in a gym by seven guys, one of them with a knife, who owed him money, et cetera. And we've discussed this case. He was murdered blatantly. Executed blatantly, which was a murder. But they murdering dozens and dozens of people, hundreds, over the last couple of months. I think 125 or 140, somebody told me that in the last 30 days. They're executing young women who protest, and some did amazingly courageous things, walking on the streets, you know, threw off the hijab and proudly walked the street till she was arrested, and you can be sure what her fate will be. So there is not one word from the United Nations, not one word from all the human rights groups, not one word from all of those who protest Israel, which engages in all sorts of humanitarian efforts, including this week taking 200 people out of Gaza to send them to hospitals abroad. It is a very serious situation. And these executions, which are apparently not Jewish, and the four spies that they executed were not Jewish, but the fact that blood can flow and they publicly hang them from cranes, 29 in one shot, and no outcry, it tells you how distorted and how warped and why we need a reset. We need a reset in America. We need a reset in the world. We need to stop the tolerance of any of this stuff on the campuses that's going on, where you could potentially have, where we've had physical assaults and potentially even worse could happen.
Jewish existence is a lonely existence, as our tradition teaches us. And Malcolm, one thing I will say about the Arvin situation, and this I know just from hearing from listeners, isn't it remarkable how we, the Jewish people, internationally and certainly based in our heritage and tradition, how seriously we take the life of one individual Jew, that people thousands of miles away made sure to set aside time every single day to pray and to advocate for him. Pretty amazing.
And one day we'll be able to tell all the efforts that were made on his behalf, by the way, also by some non-Jews, right, who were very helpful, but and Muslims, I mean, in Iran and elsewhere, who were concerned and understand. But the indifference to human life is so striking. And the nature of the enemy that Israel faces, they're barbaric. And Israel, it's demanded, should not just fight by the rules of law, which they do, the rules of war, which they do, and which they exceed in every respect, despite the media reports. But they're expected to go beyond it and to coddle these guys and to understand the nature of the enemy, driven by an extremist ideology. There's no limit to what they will do. And targeting civilians, Israel has to go, bend itself into knots to avoid civilian casualties, while the enemy fires specifically, as we saw in the last weeks, these rockets on the civilian populations in Haifa or in the north of Israel and as far down as they can get.
Certainly in central Israel, as we saw this week, but all the areas you mentioned as well. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio. Around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course, in the beloved NSN app. Malcolm Honlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations. Lots of angles regarding the election. We'll try to get to as many as possible in no particular order. Donald Trump, of course, will be the 47th president of the United States in this overwhelming victory on Tuesday. Let's start with, again, Malcolm, no particular order, but let's start with this one. Jake Novak was on and for post-election analysis actually suggested that Trump should utilize the time now as a president-elect to do certain things. And he mentioned that he thinks a trip to the Middle East and discussions with particular governments could really force some hands and please God, have the hostages released. Curious about your opinion on that. And do you think that we, Jewish people, are in a better position now to actually see the hostages come home?
So that's a lot of different questions. Number one, a trip to Middle East is possible, but it's not likely. You can only have one president at a time. It's the general rule by which they work in Washington. He can have a lot of conversations, as he is, with the leaders of the world. And he wants this war over, as he has said, before he takes office in January. Remember, it's still 70 some days till
73
till he comes, till he comes into power. So I think his words can matter. You saw that the that Morocco, for instance, already for the first time in months reaffirmed its publicly its relationship with Israel.
Wow.
And you will see more signs of this kind if the president-elect sends a consistent message in his people, and we see who gets appointed Secretary of State. Many of the names for key positions are certainly ones we would welcome and very favorable. But we'll see. We have to see first who he actually chooses. Right. So the president's first job is to start selecting the people that will run. Unlike his last time, you know, they say the Democrats, there are 4,200 jobs, I think, that come open when a president changes. Wow. The Democrats have this huge barn full of people that go in and out of government and can fill most of those jobs pretty quickly. The Republicans did not, and Trump didn't even have the Republican Party when he ran last time. You know, it was he appointed people and positions remained open throughout his term because they didn't have people in the vetting them. This time it's different. He has people. He has a lot of connections. You see a lot of good people lining up for the jobs, for the key jobs, the economic positions, foreign policy positions. So I think that they will be able to get a much better head start. And, you know, he said what he's going to do on his first day. We'll see whether that happens. But I think his commitment to wanting to end the wars and saying with Israel being victorious will be a very important message. So it's not whether he goes there, it's the messages he sends to them and the seriousness with which they take it.
Very interesting that the point you're making, and it's so obvious that but I think nonetheless needs to be pointed out, may not be obvious to everybody, and that's just how different the situation is now compared to 4 years ago when he left office. I mean, the Abraham Accords and the atmosphere of that era is just a perfect example of that. And now, obviously, there's a state of war, official or unofficial, going on in so many places, including the Middle East. And that leads to this question. The impression is, and I would suspect, that a good number of people in our Zionist community voted for Trump for this reason. But the question is, can he really give Bibi full rein at this point to do what he wants? That seemed to have been the attitude during his first administration. But now, I don't know if that attitude in Trump's mind will actually come to a closer end to the war. Can he give the Prime Minister of Israel some leeway?
He can't now. He can help set the tone. He can send the message to Israel's opponents that if you're still fighting when I get into office, I'm going to step up the efforts. He can't order additional ammunition to be sent. You saw that there was a new deal to sell F-15s, advanced F-15s to Israel, and there are shipments going in regularly, but still there is a shortage. But I think the United States is suffering from a shortage also of ammunition, and this is a situation where Israel has to become more self-reliant as they were in other areas. But for right now, Trump's words count. And in many respects, he's more powerful now in what he can say and the messages he can, then once he gets into office and is responsible for all the policies, implementation, et cetera, he can signal that the U.S.-Israel relationship is going to be stronger than ever, more effective in some respects, but most of all, to send a message that he wants those hostages released, that we're going to cut off, like he did last time, the aid to a lot of the groups. Israel broke its relationship after 50 years, I think, with UNRWA, right, long overdue, as it's a corrupt and corrupting organization. It does not mean that aid doesn't go in. Israel still works with other UN agencies, and people still don't want to listen to the facts in the general media. I'm talking about that many UNRWA leaders and officials in Gaza were involved in October 7th. More than 100 were believed to have actually taken part, and they are part of the corruption there in Gaza, and you see it with the food aid, et cetera, and the bases that they found. So I think that the president-elect can send a strong message by who he appoints, by what he says, and the message is he cannot act right now, and Congress can get a message from him, but it's really going to be until, you know, the Republicans are going to take the Senate now, and we'll see about the House very soon.
Yeah.
Those are very important.
By the way, there seems to be a debate among the Israeli press. The Jerusalem Post is reporting as of a few seconds ago, those three are still missing. Khan Israel News is saying the three are now accounted for. Let's hope the latter report is, in fact, the accurate one. All right, crazy question, especially with the analysis of Congress and so many other things, so many more important. I'm just curious, can he make a move as president to start defunding the UN or use economic pressure, since the United States, I believe, is the greatest funder of the UN, use economic pressure to have some influence there?
He did it once. There's no reason he can't do it again. And you know, I think his, I don't know who will be the ambassador to the UN and what the attitude will be, but you remember what Nikki Haley did when she was ambassador there. I think the U.S., by and large, stood Israel, but I will tell you that I've expressed this before, but I am deeply concerned that we will have a move like President Obama did just before they leave office.
Ooh.
And there could be a UN Security Council resolution, for instance, to recognize a Palestinian state,
boy,
and the U.S. not veto. There are many other possibilities. I don't want to predict it. I'm not saying that it's happening. I'm saying these are possibilities that we have to work about now, make sure that it doesn't happen. We have not seen a move in that direction. As you know, the prime minister announced a new ambassador to Israel. It's going to be Yechiel Leiter. There had been talked that
you,
it would
you,
be...
You mean to the United States?
Ambassador to the United States. Which is also a message, because he will take over in January when the transition, right, and Michael Herzog will finish his term. Those who know Yechiel know that he was chief of staff of Bibi for a long time. He lost a son at the age of 39 in the battle in last November. And he's a very articulate and strong spokesperson. I think it's a reading of the climate that will be in Washington by his appointment of Yechiel. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens between now and January 20th.
Yeah, I visited him during Shiva and was surrounded by some of the amazing heroes of the IDF. And my God, if only people around the world, Jews around the world, realize what type of commitment these soldiers have, I could go on forever about it. You mentioned Morocco. Will we see other, how's Turkey going to react? How is Saudi Arabia going to react? Are they going to make a play to find more favor in terms of a positive relationship with the United States now that Trump is coming in?
Well, it depends what the United States demands of them and asks of them. President Trump had worked towards a deal. So did this administration, trying to get a deal. Now they're supposedly negotiating a separate deal unrelated to Israel, some sort of defense accord before they go out of office. As you know, Saudi Arabia has read the inability and the to act and in ways that they consider significant in regard to their situation. And they have renewed ties with Iran. They have even done a joint naval exercise 2 weeks ago in the Red Sea with Iran. But they know what Iran is, and they're not changing the fundamental position. They know what Iran wants to do to them. And if the right messages are given now and by the incoming administration, I think that a deal with Saudi Arabia is certainly possible. I think that with other Muslim countries, there are very positive signs, and it could be a burgeoning of the Abraham Accords and maybe attendant accords that will not be exactly based on the Abraham Accords. So, yes, it's absolutely possible that we could see major changes. What we really need to see is decisive action in the Red Sea, that the Houthis, who now say that they're finished, you know, with their attacks, it's not true. They're not finished with their attacks. And they have still fired on ships in the Red Sea. They have developed their missile capacity and have strengthened their position inside Yemen, and as a bane to Saudi Arabia and to all the countries, to the UAE, to others. The West has to take action. The United States did bomb there and several times, many times, and certainly took down the rockets that were fired from there. And we should acknowledge the B-52 bombers that are now in the Middle East, that there are additional ships that were sent to the Middle East. But the bottom line situation is that the Houthis continue, survive, and grow in this. So there are many things that in Middle East and elsewhere that the new president will have to face. And, of course, he has to make decisions about the war in Ukraine. He has made statements about it, so people are speculating on it. And whether he moves to a more isolationist policy, less involvement, will he take stronger stands that will make it clear to the friends and enemies of the United States that their actions are going to, they're going to be held to account for their actions. These are all things we will have to measure and see.
We do have confirmation. Foreign Ministry is confirming that everybody now is accounted for. And police are holding 10 people in custody in Amsterdam overnight. So at least it seems there were some arrests, or at least there are some detainees. You know, someone joked when, I mean, you know, obviously it wasn't anything to laugh about, but when these rockets were fired at Israel, what you alluded to earlier about what happened earlier this week, they said once Trump won the election, now Hezbollah, the Houthis, etc., have to use up their arsenal because they're not going to have an opportunity to attack Israel a few months down the road. What is your reaction to an analysis like that?
I think it's naive. They didn't care. They don't know what happens to Yemen. They don't care what happens to their own troops. You saw it when Israel hit the port and still put, and it's still out of function, and then hit the other port in Hodeidah. And these guys are driven by radical ideological extremists, religious and theocratic ideologies. They are funded by Iran. So until we take out the core, the head of the snake, as is said, but this is the core of the problem in the Middle East, which is if you stop Iran, you stop the problems. Houthis, Hezbollah, Hamas, the militias in Iraq and Syria, who they are arming now, and they have shipped more weapons in Israel, obviously monitoring it. You see they still take action in Syria and elsewhere. That the goal was always to try to get as close in Syria to the Golan Heights and repeatedly made effort to encroach and to infiltrate into the Syrian forces there to be able to hit. So the panoply of issues that we face, the seven-sided war, has one fulcrum, and that's Iran. If the administration really takes the steps, and we could crush Iran. Did you see there were signs in people painted graffiti in Tehran recently, and it said, Israel, bomb them. We will take care of the rest in the streets.
Wow.
And people don't know it. They don't get the encouragement, the support. They don't get the messages that we will help them. America doesn't have to bomb them. The people of Iran will do the job. And as I have predicted before in your show, even years ago, that ultimately I believe Iran will become one of Israel's best friends in the region because the people want it.
And on top of that, taming Iran might discourage people from beating up Jews in the streets of Europe as well.
Of course, they're behind it, just like they are behind a lot of the stuff that's going on here. These are not spontaneous things. The Chinese pay for the demonstrations on our campuses. Qatar spending billions and billions in K-12. People should please read the reports. I've warned about it. I've talked about it. Now we've made public the work of NCRI, based out of Rutgers, is amazing, exposing what is happening. The groups of teachers and the New York City Public School Alliance and the other groups that teachers and parents who are exposing what's happening from in kindergartens to 12th grade, let alone what's happening on our campuses. The whole fulcrum of this whole network of hostility on our campuses, which is continuing, it has not diminished. It will all change if we see prosecutions We want to see Title VI Act more imposed. We want to see the Department of Education, which was doing it in the previous administration and in this case has done some, but they don't follow up. And there's no, you see that people, a few presidents resign, but the basic policies have not changed. So now they announce neutrality. It can't be neutral when students are being attacked. We have to see that this stops. And again, the hostility on so many of the campuses. I spoke to kids from Tulane. I spoke to kids from other places which have large Jewish student populations today. And they tell me tales of horror still.
Unbelievable. How do you explain the inability of Kamala Harris to carry Dearborn, Michigan?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say something which I probably can't prove completely, but my instincts in politics is generally pretty good. Being pro-Israel does not lose you elections in America. It helps you. And a Pennsylvania senator, Utterman,
even in Dearborn?
Yeah. So there, first of all, you have a lot of the Arabs in Dearborn are Christians. They're not Muslims.
Right. Lebanese.
And doesn't mean they're not radicalized. They have radicalized the populations and they want to show their bona fides so that often some of them are more extreme than the Muslims. But the fact is that they say they want peace, that a lot of them, older people especially, I think, do not want to see their countries destroyed, their home countries destroyed, and want to see some sort of reconciliation, even if only for their own purposes. But the fact is that, and I said this on the air once in the summer, that an analyst showed me that while there are many more Muslims than Jews in Michigan, there are more Jews who vote than they in Michigan. Right. So you have to look at that. Number two, that the President Trump saying to them that he wants peace. They don't trust the Democrats. And again, I would say that around the country, being pro-Israel helps, doesn't hurt in your election with non-Jewish populations as well.
And you were citing something about Fetterman. I interrupted you. What was that point, please?
My point was, look at Fetterman. He's up. He stands up clearly in interviews in the last week and a half saying, I'm standing with Israel. I don't care about any of the rest of it. And as a Democratic senator, he's not, his numbers keep going up. And it's true of others as well. Those who turned against Israel find themselves isolated and winning very little favor, and that the people are so extreme that they're not really supporting them. So it's Democrats and Republicans alike. We need to make sure that those who stand with us get elected and know that the Lawlers of the world and the Haddas and all the others who came through difficult races. Being pro-Israel is being pro-America, and the voters will support you.
Are you worried about anything else in this transition aside from the UN venue that you explained to us could be a place where the United States or the current administration takes some action that would be against Israel? Well understood. We hop that, so to speak. Is there anything else you fear could happen from the White House before they leave?
Yes, there are a lot of policies that could be implemented or people who have agendas trying to force a resolution rather than assuring that Israel will be secure in the future. On the other hand, I think there could be good things that the administration can do to help bolster Israel's strength. Reason I cited some of the positive things that they are doing in terms of sending weapons and the aircraft and other aircraft carriers are all significant, but we have to see that it's reinforced and that the message is clear, because we cannot afford to have Iran feel that they can attack Israel again with a couple hundred missiles. You notice that they haven't done it till now. You notice that the bravado in words is not matched by deeds, right, because they know what the response this time will be. So it could be positive things. Again, I hope that the members of Congress, the members of the administration will work to implement positive agendas in supporting the U.S.-Israel relationship, which will strengthen our hand and our allies in the region, because they look at that as a barometer. And we often send the wrong signal. Israel has done incredible things and acted with such restraint in Lebanon, in in Gaza, despite the numbers that they claim, which we don't know what's true and what's not true because it's coming from Hamas authorities or Hezbollah authorities. But the remarkable restraint that Israel's demonstrating is incredible. Remember that 80,000 people are still out of their homes.
Yep.
Remember that the north of Israel is coming under increasing attack, and all the numbers of widows and 60 orphans just since September that because of the parents killed in action.
Yeah, of course. Finally, Malcolm, I have no idea in your voting career if you've voted for more Democrats or Republicans. You certainly have known all the leaders of both parties, past leaders and current leaders. Are you somewhat, from a political science standpoint, are you somewhat amazed at the lack of self-analysis, lack of introspection at this point by the Democratic Party?
Well, actually, I think that there are serious people introspecting right now, trying to figure out what went wrong, to what degree does the candidate matter, to what degree did the shift, did the, you know, the, and the policies, certainly the economic policies, immigration policies, other things, and abortion rights was a factor for many people. But the I think they will analyze the losses and see the trends in the country, which they thought would move the other way, especially amongst young people. We see that Hispanics voted in different patterns than traditionally. So I think there will be, on both parties, an effort to reach out and to assess, definitely assessing what happened. I think some of them are stunned by what happened, having thought that they were going to waltz into this presidency. So, yes, I think there's going to be a lot of analysis. There's going to be, and it should be taking place in our community as well, where we assess how do we increase the vote, how do we make sure that the numbers we reached in many communities this time is sustained, the number of voters who turned out, that educate the younger generation and reach out to the community, our community at large, to be more involved.
Do you have an estimate yet on the Jewish vote? Do we have an estimate nationwide on the Jewish vote yet from Tuesday? Anybody know?
The numbers?
Yeah, like what percentage?
Look, I, for one, am very skeptical. I don't believe that the polls are right. I don't think that the divisions that they say are right. I think Trump probably overall maybe got a third of the Jewish vote.
You don't think he got 40% nationwide?
I do think in New York he got 40%.
Right, but not nationwide.
It's hard to tell. First of all, Jews are such a small percentage in polls that it's very hard. Second of all, you have to poll. Depends which neighborhoods you poll. If you poll based upon the five towns and Flatbush, he got 80% of the vote.
Right.
If you do it based on the Upper West Side, Upper East Side, or someplace,
Greenwich,
you got 25% of the vote.
If you're up in Greenwich taking a poll, it'll be different, right?
That's for sure. Yeah, Westport, Connecticut's Jewish vote was different.
But that's interesting that nationwide you don't think you'll hit 40, but it still has a chance to be the highest ever nationwide, or Reagan or others will
Reagan,
still...
Well, if you remember that I said that I believed it would be Reagan-like numbers, still believe that it's Reagan-like numbers. I think that the ability to reach out to, but also just don't look at the presidential race. Look at the congressional races. Look where the communities came out. And, you know, because you can have a personal gripe with Trump or you don't like some policy or something about it. But in terms, I think more and more people are not going to vote the label, meaning that P or an R or an I. They're going to vote the individual, and which I have always done, and I never disclose how I vote, and people can't tell because I don't want people to skew people's perception of what you're saying.
I
care about the policy, and I look obviously at the individual, but you look at what the policies and what they're likely to do. I think that when you analyze the congressional races, people will see a big, big shift.
I thank you very much. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak again next week. Malcolm Homeline, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, weekly update, hour number two and three. How do you like that? 7:40 a.m. Eastern Time here on a Friday at JM in the AM.